From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and here are the issues. Donald Trump, the frontrunner in the furious race for the Republican presidential nomination, declared that riots may occur if he is denied the nomination. President Obama, meanwhile, named a federal judge, Merrick Garland, for a seat on the Supreme Court, but Republicans said they would neither hold hearings or vote on the nomination. Russia will begin withdrawing its military forces from Syria, President Vladimir Putin announced, but it will continue to back Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And a Kurdish group declared a section of northeastern Syria to be a Kurdish federal enclave, an autonomous enclave, defying the United States, Turkey, and the Assad government. Well, since the biggest issue in the United States, Barbara and Tom, is Donald Trump, I think we'll start with Donald Trump. He does say some amazing things in this thing about riots. I don't know whether he was just shooting off his mouth, as he frequently does, but or whether that is something serious. But what about it? He is now, Tom, closer than ever to winning the Republican presidential nomination, really dividing the Republican Party.
Right. I think I've been predicting a Republican civil war since long before Donald Trump came on the scene, and I think the odds of that are ever more likely. Mm-hmm. He has continued a steady march toward the Republican nomination. He won Florida. He came in a close second in Ohio in recent days. But he is continuing to gain delegates. And if you just look at this on sheer mathematics, he has the best chance mm-hmm. of winning. But it's also quite clear that he may fall a little bit short.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the hope of the Republican establishment, which is adopted basically in anybody but Trump
mm-hmm.
attitude to try to stop him. The Republican establishment in Washington loathes mm-hmm. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. They think he's creepy. They think he will drive the party over a cliff. They think he will produce President Clinton, but they think he's less odious than Donald Trump. And so mm-hmm. grudgingly, the Republican establishment is starting to wrap its arms around Senator Cruz. But
what about John Kasich, the governor of Ohio? He's still in the race here.
The last time I checked, it looked like he needed to win 110% of the remaining delegates to win the nomination. Mm-hmm. So mathematically, mm-hmm. he doesn't have a chance. But having won his home state of Ohio with 66 delegates, he can go to the convention as a broker. So there's no reason to think he's going to drop out and coalesce around Ted Cruz, who mm-hmm. he can't stand either. So you just get a feeling that no good is coming, going to come of this. And Trump, for all his bluster, for all the stupid things he says, for all the divisive things he says, is probably still got a leg up on being mm-hmm. the Republican nominee, whether mm-hmm. the establishment likes it or not, and they clearly don't.
Well, what a happy party. Barbara, what about a Stop Trump movement, which is underway? These Stop movements usually, in any nomination fight or in other things, they start too late and they really don't succeed.
Yeah, well, if you're a Democrat, I suppose you're enjoying watching Republicans pour millions and millions of dollars, down the drain trying to stop Trump. But now you all are much more expert in this than I, but I've been reading about all these complicated ways of stopping Trump, that if he doesn't get 1,237 delegates going into the convention, that after the first vote, theoretically, all of his or many of his delegates could be released and could vote for someone else. So you
indeed.
Could have something really Hollywood, dramatic where there is a mass move toward Cruz or toward Kasich or even somebody else. And there was a column that Chris Saliza also wrote in the Washington Post recently. He noted that in California there are 172 delegates at stake, and he thought that that the California primary would also be crucial in terms of distributing delegates and maybe keeping Trump from going over the 1,237 threshold. So I ask you, is it feasible that over 1,000 delegates pledged to Trump would suddenly switch and move toward another candidate if he doesn't get it on the first ballot?
You know, usually they don't, but this may be a different case. You know, usually, Barbara, the campaigns have picked out the delegates specifically. You know, this is a Trump person.
And they haven't done – I mean, these are professional Republican apparatchiks who probably don't like Trump who are the delegates, yeah?
No. These will be a delegate slate that's picked by the campaign. And they're usually people that are very loyal. And, in fact, they'll often vote for specific delegates. So we'll see. But after the first ballot, of course, they will be freed. And then what, Tom?
One of the strategies the Stop Trump people are employing is trying to put the delegates through a process where they can identify people who are more than willing to stick with Trump for one ballot, but will go to Cruz or to Kasich or somebody else. Mm-hmm. So there basically is this furious accumulation process going on of trying to get votes for a second ballot. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that strikes me about this, Fred, is that it's, as you know, we haven't seen this since 1976. And even in 1976, when Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford were locked in this furious battle, which Ford won by about 110 delegates at the Kansas City Convention, it still was decided before the first ballot or on the first ballot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you have to go back to Taft,
the
50s, Eisenhower,
the 50s, yeah. or 40s, mm-hmm.
52 or 48 or something like that, where there was actually a contested convention. So it is, it's been an awfully long time before something like this happens. The question I always ask Republican establishment people who are very much involved in this Stop Trump process is, how do you bring back the millions of disaffected Trump voters who are angry not only at President Obama and Hillary Clinton, but also sick and tired of the Republican leadership in Washington? How do you get them back in the tent if you deny Trump the nomination or if Trump falls short? And nobody's got a good answer for that.
Well, there isn't a good answer for that. That's why, I mean, either way. But if you nominate Trump, I mean, if he actually becomes a Republican nominee, then you have the problem there of many defectors. I know many of them here in Washington who won't vote, who say they won't vote for Trump, and then others who are starting to, and I think will succeed in fielding a third-party conservative Republican candidate against Trump. And all this will lead to Hillary Clinton's being the next president of the United States. Well, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news. We'll touch on Trump some, but we have other issues to do as well.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts. And keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Tom DeFrank. What more do we have to discuss about Trump, Tom? We've already got him with another candidate running against him, and then there's Hillary Clinton. Now, look, maybe I exaggerated about this third-party candidate, but there's certainly people who don't like Trump in the Republican Party and want to come up with the candidate.
Well, I want to just raise two quotes. We ought to have a standing item on this show, the Trumpism of the week.
I know which one you're going to go to.
Well,
go
actually,
ahead.
I'm thinking of two. One is, he said, if I'm denied the nomination, there'll probably be riots.
Yep.
And I say, if there are riots, it'll probably be riots that he has instigated himself. But the all-time classic Trumpism of the week was when he was asked by MSNBC who he talks to for advice on foreign policy, and he said, "Well, myself, because I've got a good brain."
That's a perfect segue into this little.
Yeah,
factoid.
But it's also honest, though.
Yeah, the Economist Intelligence Unit has listed its top 10 global risks. Mm-hmm. And it starts with China and Russia and the Ukraine and Syria, blah, 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 blah. But a Trump presidency is on their list of top 10 global risks in the coming year. I think it's before the rising risk of jihadi terrorism. So, you know, that shows you what the world is thinking about this. And we really have to bear in mind that it's not just the United States that's being convulsed by a possible Trump nomination, but our allies, our friends are really, really worried about this.
You can imagine what ambassadors to other countries cable back to their capitals after the "I talk to myself on foreign policy" line from Mr. Trump.
Hey, he said of himself that he's his own consultant. Let's not belabor this issue.
In fairness to him, he is a smart guy.
Yeah.
But smart guys also do stupid things, and sometimes smart guys say stupid things. Mm-hmm. And that was not a helpful thing for him to say that.
We avoid that on this show. We don't do anything like that. Well, let's talk about this Supreme Court nomination that is going to create an impasse, at least for now. What about it, Barbara?
Well, I mean, Merrick Garland is, as good a nominee as the Republicans could hope for, I think, from a Democratic president. So there's a question. I mean, a lot of people are trying to figure out now whether it makes more sense to confirm him or to wait to see whether Hillary Clinton indeed does become the next president of the United States. Mm-hmm. With the understanding that she might nominate someone who is more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Garland is a centrist. He's got a wonderful biography. He was a scholarship student at Harvard. He put himself through Harvard Law School partly by selling his comics collection. Very humble. Had a job with a fancy white shoe firm and quit it to work for the Justice Department. Took a 50% pay cut. Was a prosecutor during the horrible events after the Oklahoma City bombing. And what's more, there are miles and miles of tape of Republicans praising him to the skies when he was approved for the D.C. Circuit Court by a 76-23 vote majority, including many, many, many prominent Republicans. So, you know, they're playing games. They're saying, oh, we won't have hearings. But an increasing number of Republican senators are now saying they will at least meet with him.
Some of them, although I think it really comes down to one person. It's Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, who has laid down this rule. If you can't change his mind, it's going to be hard to get this nomination through.
You know, Fred, I think the Republicans are on the defensive, but you're right. Mm-hmm. There is no way if the Senate Majority Leader is taking this position, and I think he's got a lot of support in his own party for this, it's hard to see how anything comes to this.
Yeah, but don't you think this was, as Barbara was suggesting, a very clever nomination to pick somebody like Merrick Garland?
It
really puts more pressure on Republicans.
Right, and it puts more pressure on Republicans, the six or seven Senate Republican incumbents who are running in states that Barack Obama won last time around.
Mm-hmm.
They're really in a bind. I mean, I think this was, if you assume that everything is political in Washington, this was smart politics because I think President Obama is going to be able to run he's going to be able to position the party in the fall as the party of progressivism trying to fight the liberal conservative Huns who would turn down this good man. I think the Democrats have position themselves pretty well on that. And all the more reason I say that is because President Obama could have put, as you both have said, could have put forward a far more liberal person, but he didn't. I mean, he couldn't put forward a very prominent South Asian, Asian American. There are a couple of other people he could have put forward, and then the Republicans would have said, "Well, he's just playing politics." Well, they're saying that anyway, but it's
playing politics. I mean, that's a part of it. I mean, Tom,
but he is harder.
If Democrats were in the same position that Republicans are in now, don't you think they'd be doing the same thing?
Precisely,
as many of them have said in the past.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing to do.
No,
just because
it
Democrats would have done it.
No, no, but you know, I agree. But it does suggest that there's an element of hypocrisy here. Now,
hypocrisy in Washington.
I know, hypocrisy in Washington.
I'm shocked.
Who can believe that? But anyway,
have
we exhausted this one? Or
well,
I want to.
Could I just?
Sure.
There was a lovely piece in the Washington Post by Stu Eisenstadt, who Truth in Lending is the co-chair of my advisory board on Iran. He's a former Deputy Treasury Secretary. He was Jimmy Carter's chief of staff. And he talked about how Stephen Breyer, who's now a justice on the Supreme Court, was approved in an election year, a lame duck, you know, president to a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And Breyer was suggested by the late Senator Ted Kennedy, who was no friend of Jimmy Carter's, but nevertheless, Carter agreed to put his name forward. And the real impediment would have been Strom Thurmond, who you remember was a diehard conservative senator. And the column simply describes the way it was done, where basically Ted Kennedy said to Stu Eisenstadt, look, you get Carter to agree, and he said, I'll get Strom to agree. Mm-hmm. And such was the nature of the Senate in those days, the collegiality, and we're talking over 30 years ago now, that, you know, Kennedy was able to convince Strom Thurmond that Stephen Breyer was a good candidate and, you know, should be approved, and the fact that, that Carter was a lame duck, you know, should not prevent. And so he went on to the circuit court, and then, of course, later on he went on to the Supreme Court. You know, whatever happened to those days, that's the question.
Well, there's no Edward Kennedy anymore, and and he had a particular role there. Stephen Breyer had been the staff director of the Senate Judiciary Committee that Kennedy was the chairman of, and well, as you
and
say,
got along very well with Strom Thurmond's staff as well. So those were the days.
Those were the days. Those were different days. All right, time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Barbara Slavin. Look, we've got a small amount of time and a couple of issues to do, and so let's do them. What about Vladimir Putin saying he's pulling out a substantial amount, I guess, of the military forces in Syria? Is he going to have a you know, a big sign on the Kremlin that says "Mission accomplished"? Barbara,
pretty much. You know, I got to hand it to this guy. He consults almost no one. He has a very small group of advisors, and he loves to sort of make these decisions and drop them on the world like small bombs. Obama didn't know about it. The Iranians didn't know about it. I doubt that Bashar al-Assad knew about it. And, you know, all of a sudden he's announcing the withdrawal, and he's starting to pull there were about 4,000 Russians based in Syria. He's keeping a naval base at Tartus. He's keeping a special air base. So it's not as though it's a total withdrawal. But many of these people will be coming home. Many of the planes will be coming home. So, yeah, he's declaring mission accomplished. He has a reason, I think. Assad is much, much stronger than he was 5 months ago. Syrian government now controls more territory. And Assad's position, bargaining position, is much improved for peace talks, which may or may not get anywhere.
Tom, what about the quagmire declared by President Obama that the Russians would be stuck in because of this military intervention ordered by Vladimir Putin?
Well, I don't think that's the case anymore. I mean, I take Putin at his word that most of these troops will be out of there, and will still have enough of a presence to help enforce a negotiated ceasefire if he wants to, and to help prop up Assad, but it does not look like an open-ended quagmire that the Obama administration was predicting. And, of course, he's got problems with his budget since his oil revenues have dropped by tens of billions of dollars. So anything he can save, the New York Times said that this, according to Putin, that this operation cost $500 million.
Yep.
And so I'm sure it was more than that.
Yeah, it must have cost more than that. This
but this is
wasn't it, though, the quagmire idea was based on the troops on the ground, right?
Right.
More than the air power.
Right, and they're getting out of there for the most part. I'm sure there'll be some Russian special operators and a few other soldiers and airmen to man the advanced missile defense systems that are still going to be in place in Syria. But, I mean, to the average Russian who is seeing his or her standard of living go down, 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 and down, this doesn't look like yet another reckless intervention, especially since the numbers of troops and people and equipment is not that big anymore.
Well, let's turn to the Kurds lastly here. And, you know, I remember when I first started covering the White House, Tom, you were there for Newsweek at the time, and I started hearing about the Kurds. I'd never heard of them before, and this was back in the 70s now. This is a long time ago, and they wanted independence, and we've been going through this for years, but all the countries that they live in, well, what is it, Turkey, Iran, Syria,
Iraq,
that's four countries. None of those four countries wants an independent Kurdish state. Well, anyway, this group has declared an autonomous state in Syria, and nobody seems to want that except the Kurds either.
Well, I mean, it exists. One of the consequences of the Syrian civil war has been a complete collapse of government control over large areas of the country, including an area that is heavily Kurdish. And backed by the United States and Russia, the Kurdish forces there have taken more territory, ostensibly to push back against the Islamic State. But they've also carved out little pieces that were not Islamic mm-hmm. State, but, you know, belong to other Arab groups. And so it exists. It's called Rojava, and it's getting bigger all the time. And it's driving the Turks in particular nuts, but it's not clear what they can do about it.
The Democratic Federation of Rojava, North Syria.
There you go.
Thanks to Barbara for helping with the pronunciation. But in Iraq, and I hope you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Barbara, the Kurds have basically put together what I call a de facto Kurdistan.
Yeah,
and the Iraqis aren't thrilled with it, but it's probably the one area of Iraq that's functioning pretty well. So I think and the Kurds have probably helped their credibility by doing such a good job on the military front in this part of the world. And so I don't think the world is going to rise up and try to throw the Kurds out of their new enclave. I think it'll be one of those. We don't like it, but so it goes.
Why does the Obama administration oppose this, the U.S. government?
It's because the Turks are very anxious about their own Kurdish minority and are fighting a war against a group called the PKK, which is Turkish Kurds, and the Turks assert that the Syrian Kurds and the PKK are basically one and the same organization, and they actually have some basis for saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So Turkey's a NATO ally, and so the U.S. has to, you know, at least pretend to be upset.
What about the Turkish deal with the EU to stop migrants from moving out of Turkey into Greece and then into Western Europe, Barbara? Where how does that stand?
Well, that's very controversial also. I mean, it would pay the Turks a great deal of money. It would also allow them a fast track into the European Union. And we should note that besides bombarding the Kurds, Erdogan, the Turkish president, has been cracking down fiercely on all political opposition, on media. Turkey is one of the most repressive places in the region now and really not fit to be a member of the EU, in my humble estimation. So this is a controversial deal. Not clear that it would even really stop the flow of migrants out of Syria. The only thing that will stop the flow is a durable ceasefire and a political solution to the Syria civil war.
Well, that's not going to happen overnight, Tom.
No, I mean, I think the impetus in this part of the world is for less benevolence towards the migrants. I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that opposition parties in Germany have done very well in recent days in provincial regional elections, a rebuff to Chancellor Angela Merkel, and she's read these political tea leaves and is starting to talk a little tougher than she was when she was welcoming.
Yeah. Basically, they want the Turks to keep these people and not let them go on to Greece and to Europe.
Well, I was struck by the incentives that they gave the Turks, and you mentioned, I mean, not only money, but as you called it, a fast track into the EU, and I'm trying to think of the others. But
also free movement for Turks into Europe.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a very sweet package, and
the
question is, does Turkey really deserve it?
Mm-hmm. Well, why hasn't it been finalized, Barbara?
I think it's opposition among some of the European countries. Mm-hmm. The Turks, I think, are very pleased by the package, but it's Europe. It's 28 countries that have to agree.
Mm-hmm. Well, Turkey, they are a member of NATO.
They are a member of NATO and a critical member of NATO. U.S. has got at least two air bases in Turkey that have proved very, very helpful in recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So, but I think you're right. I don't think we should see them in the EU for a while,
if ever.
That's
a long time.
That's a long time.
that is a long time. Well, I was just throwing that out.
What does President Trump think about?
President Trump has to consult himself and decide what he thinks about this. So.
Indeed. That's pretty easy to do, I would think. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.